fear for us is that this war on terrorism has unleashed a polarization of the world, which, if it takes place outside a framework of multilateral agreement and effort to seek consensus and of rules, you know, really does risk setting one part of the world against another in a way that certainly would have the consequences of causing humanity huge distress and hardship in the decades ahead.
Here's a lesson for great powers. From Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, and maybe even in Gaza and Ukraine, why does the militarily weaker side lose many battles yet eventually win the war? I'm Gavin Essler. This is Not a Drill. In the jargon of security and intelligence experts, Hamas, the Taliban, the Viet Cong, Hezbollah, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Islamic State, and even in the UK, the IRA are or were non-state actors practicing asymmetric warfare. How is it these weaker forces practice a kind of strategic jiu-jitsu to defeat much greater military forces? In a moment, we'll disentangle the jargon and some of these asymmetric conflicts with David Uko, Professor at the College of International Security Affairs in Washington, D.C.'s National Defense University. But first, a recently published high-level annual report from the Brookings Institution warns that instability generated by non-state armed actors and threats posed by illegal economies will grow in 2024, jeopardizing a wide range of U.S. interests as regional and global powers look to exploit them. The author of that report is Vanda Felbab-Brown. I noticed that in January you wrote that instability will grow in 2024. Can you give us some background to that? Why did you raise the alarm on this, and what's the problem?
Well, instability, threats generated by non-state armed actors are going to intensify this year. They are already intensifying. And there are multiple sources, both in terms of insurgency, terrorist groups, as well as illegal economies. First of all, the Gaza war activated non-state armed actors across Middle East, gave them far more legitimacy than they had before, and significantly upped the military action, their audacity, their motivation to resort to levels of violence that we have not seen. So the Houthis in Yemen attacking ships in the Red Sea, but also pro-Iranian paramilitary groups in Iraq, really increasing pressure on the United States, on U.S. assets, to drive the U.S. out of Iraq. Exchanges between Hezbollah and Israel. Those are all just samples of the fervent that is and turmoil that is going across the entire Middle East as a result of the Gaza war. In West Africa, instability has been building up for a considerable amount of time and has really not been adequately addressed by anyone, including not by Russia, whether through the formal support that the Russian government is signing with various African countries, most recently the DRC, or through the Russian proxy groups, Wagner Group, today renamed Africa Corps. So very significant jihadi activities across the Sahel with Islamic State affiliates, Al-Qaeda affiliates, really threatening population centers, major cities in Mali, spilling into Burkina Faso, spilling into Togo. Up on the east side of Africa, Al-Shabaab has not been defeated as was predicted. It survived militia uprisings that have emerged. And of course, in Africa also, we have very significant intensification of violence in the DRC that I mentioned. If we jump the ocean in the Americas, we have violence generated by criminal groups. And this violence that had long been there is now compounded by the fact that two large Mexican cartels, the Sinaloa cartel and cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion, are expanding their reach really across the entire Americas and beyond the Americas into Africa, into Asia, in Europe. And overlaying all of this picture is a global revolution in synthetic drugs that is playing out across drug markets and criminal markets from Australia and New Zealand to Asia, Europe, to the Middle East, and to the United States. And it has different manifestations to it, but in very many places, this is associated with either already intensified violence or the possibility of a much intensified violence.
We'll hear more from Vanda in a moment. But what can be done about these hugely diverse groups and geographical threats? There's clearly no one-size-fits-all solution. David Uko teaches irregular warfare and strategy at Washington's National Defense University and is an expert on how to handle or mishandle such conflicts. David is also the author of Counterinsurgency and Crisis: Britain and the Challenges of Modern Warfare, and also The New Counterinsurgency Era, Transforming the US Military for Modern Wars. David, can we begin with a few definitions? Because I think we've all heard terms like asymmetric warfare, irregular warfare, hybrid warfare, and so on. Do they all kind of mean the same thing?
Well, it's a good question. It's really grounded in what I see as a misconception about what warfare really looks like. We have this idea that it should look like Saving Private Ryan, or what we remember from the First and Second World War. And every time war comes around and surprises us by failing to take that form, we scurry to find some sort of word with which to describe this unexpected reality. And we now have hybrid warfare, we have irregular warfare, we have asymmetric warfare. They all mean slightly different things, but I think sort of for the layperson, effectively what it means is that war doesn't subscribe to the rules and norms that we had expected it to. And so we have to then deal with its full complexity, its political, economic, societal, and informational dynamics.
I expect the words may sound new to some people, but actually the idea isn't really that new, is it? I mean, just in most recent history, the Viet Cong in Vietnam were there because that's where they lived. And so therefore, for the American forces, it was always going to be very difficult to defeat them. And the same is true in Iraq, same is true in Palestine and lots of other places.
Yeah, I mean, it's a curious paradox, I guess, of the US certainly, and I think the same goes for most NATO countries, that they've actually experienced war of this type far more regularly than the conventional combat for which we keep preparing, and yet we don't quite make the alterations in our doctrine or in our training and our professional military education. And certainly traumatic experiences such as Vietnam don't seem to have made much of a difference. In fact, the overriding lesson at the end of that conflict was not to learn from it. And one might say a similar phenomenon has happened post-Afghanistan. There is another component to this, of course, which is that from a UK or from a US or really from a European perspective, these conflicts are always played out in someone else's country, as you point out. And that adds a further dimension of complexity. But that is not to say that these conflicts do not also happen in host nations, as we may call them, which is to say, Colombia has its own insurgency problem, Peru has had its, Thailand, Philippines, the list goes on. So that's a distinction that is quite important to this discussion, which we discuss further.
And of course, the IRA in the United Kingdom, it's not something that we in Britain certainly have been immune to either.
Right, absolutely. No, I mean, it's politics, you know, and politics, when it doesn't work through, you know, democratic processes and through what sociologists call the political opportunity structure, that is to say, the ability to express your preferences and mediate your grievances through the system, well, then, you know, some people resort to violence. And then you have a political problem inflamed by bloodshed. It's one of those things that we have to get better at managing, rather than again and again reverting to this idea that, you know, technology will save the day.
Maybe the opposite will happen, because technology means that drones, for example, are pretty cheap. Same is true of cyber. A guy with a computer somewhere in St. Petersburg can cause a great deal of disruption. So actually, changing weapons have revolutionized hybrid warfare too, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So earlier when I mentioned that, you know, we have to reckon with war's societal, political, informational dynamics, you know, it really goes up against this dichotomy or this idea that there's war and there is peace. That just doesn't work. We see increasingly a fusion between these worlds, and that's what we're struggling with. And so, as you mentioned, technology, certainly the cheap availability of drones, either for surveillance, but also, as we've seen, it can be sort of fixed up to actually carry explosive devices, allows then even fairly rudimentary groups to extend their reach and their destructive potential. And that should really force us to recalculate what we mean by, you know, force protection, a sense of security. I mean, we have put a lot of stock in fences and walls, for example. You know, and we may be approaching a period where those things are sort of laughably inadequate. And distance. I mean, what does it mean if you can fly a drone, you know, from North Africa to Southern Europe and with pinpoint accuracy, drive it right into a civilian airport? And not just one drone, but as we've seen, also swarms of drones. If, you know, the miniaturization of these things, 3D printing, and the commercial availability all continue to increase.
That is a very interesting point, a very disturbing point too. And I wondered, is there a way of approaching it just having a, just briefly suggesting what on the global map should we look at to see where the major flashpoints are? Because my sense is, from reading quite a lot of news, almost everywhere.
Well, yes. I mean, it depends a little bit what category of conflict that we're talking about. And so, obviously, you know, we have the situation in Russia and Ukraine, and one could add to that Hamas and Israel. But then, of course, there are these insurgent conflicts. And unfortunately, of course, as we see really across the Sahel, so Mali, Niger, and spreading in Nigeria, but also in South America and Colombia, we have a resurgent FARC and other criminal organizations in Asia and Mindanao, Pakistan, Afghanistan, of course. These insurgent problems have not gone away, and particularly because of this sort of globalized agendas and ideologies, it's something that I think we need to probably pay closer attention to, not least when you add then this reality of much more capable non-state armed groups who can actually inflict damage and harm far across, far from their own national borders.
What are the consequences then for what one might call the traditional armed forces of the US, the UK, elsewhere in NATO? I mean, one thing is obvious, we're using million-pound missiles or million-dollar missiles to attack those using drones that cost a fraction of that. So that's with the Houthis. So that's part of it. I mean, is there a real problem in thinking about how we may have to restructure military spending, perhaps in the British case, away from massive aircraft carriers, which in the case of at least one of them doesn't work very well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's not too grandiose to say that we may be on the verge of a real paradigm shift. I mean, one may even think of a revolution in military affairs because of the effects of artificial intelligence, of the precision-guided munitions, the availability of military technology to non-state armed groups, and the impossibility, therefore, of really prevailing just through these heavy, big, and very expensive weapon systems that we have come to rely upon. And so, what does it mean? I think it's going to require us to be far more nimble and creative and really savvy, and not to look at military capability in terms of how many of the latest generation fighter jets we have, but rather what's their survivability in an actual combat situation? How can you prevent them from being targeted by, say, a swarm of automated loitering munitions that are hovering around the place waiting for any sign of anything before they strike? I mean, you don't need to cause much damage if you can pinpoint an attack on one of these things, and thereby, in the asymmetry of spending alone, cause disproportionate damage in a sort of combat situation. So we haven't really gone the full distance in terms of what that means. And I don't want to be too cynical here, but there are fairly significant forces that are keeping us back because, of course, this sort of investment patterns, there's a lot of money, R&D, and the whole sort of iron triangle, as we call it here in the United States, between the defense manufacturers, Congress, and politicians and so on. So it's not easy to turn this machinery around, but I think lessons from Ukraine, lessons from Iraq, but also Israel, Gaza, et cetera, point in a new direction that if we don't catch up, you know, we're going to be left behind. The challenging aspect of this, of course, is that we're doing this whilst we're also ramping up, you know, against this potential flashpoint in the Indo-Pacific. It's a high-risk enterprise, and if you don't get the bets right, you know, obviously, the consequences could be fairly costly.
That's a very, very good point, because it's not do one thing or the other. It's perhaps doing both and. In other words, there is a what we might call relatively conventional possibilities in the Indo-Pacific with China, and there clearly is a relatively conventional war going on in Eastern Europe right now. So those have to be prepared for as well as all this.
Yeah, and the thing there, it really gets back to your first question about this hybridity issue, because we have, again, you know, it's another one of those dichotomies or dualities that we have embraced, which is that states operate conventionally through tanks and aircraft carriers, etc., and non-state armed groups use insurgencies and improvised explosive devices, AK-47s. And in a sense, we then see ourselves toggling between one or the other. But I think anyone who cares to look into this will find that there's actually far more commonality between these two different types of wars, let's say, than meets the eye. And what do I mean by that? Well, certainly the type of weaponry has changed in Russia. It looks very different from a sort of order of battle perspective than any insurgent group. But the point is, that really just speaks to the correlation of forces or the level of lethality that you can impose. What is the same is that we're still operating in a highly mediatized environment where narratives and perceptions of legitimacy and the notion of whom do I support can be strategically decisive. We're still operating fundamentally with questions of will to fight. Who actually wants to stand up and defend their homeland? These factors that I'm pointing to really speak to the social and political realities of warfare, and the fact that it's just a fundamentally political endeavor, much as Klaus had sort of said. You know, it's really time, it's overdue even, to come to terms with what war actually means and to prepare accordingly. And that means not just gauging our military and making sure that it is, you know, up to speed with the latest developments, but really in actually engaging with other instruments of national power, be it, you know, economics, but also information and narratives. You know, what is it that we're fighting for? What is our vision? How do we communicate it? And to, I guess, mobilize really for the full complexity of the matter.
I was thinking as you were speaking there of something that the IRA said when they failed to blow up Mrs. Thatcher, but they tried to blow up the British Prime Minister or tried to murder her. And they said, we only have to be lucky once, you have to be lucky every time. And there's something in that of all these asymmetric warfare battles, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly that dimension, and not least, again, as we've discussed, with the increased lethality and destructiveness that now find themselves in the hands of non-state armed groups. I think perhaps one root of the problem is that many states have gotten accustomed to simply suppressing the problem, or perhaps, if I want to be a little bit more generous, managing it, containing it. We used to have a situation in the Cold War where, you know, guerrillas and national liberation fronts would sort of take over countries and actually overthrow the government. And it made many states feel quite nervous, particularly those lacking in any sort of real popular legitimacy. We don't really see that so much, you know, certainly since the turn of the century. What we see instead is a number of ongoing conflicts of insurgent variety, where the state sort of operates between a combination of neglect and repression. And, you know, you can call this kicking the can down the road, you call it mowing the grass, you can call it anything you want. But many states actually find that they are doing well enough by doing just enough. And that's a very seductive strategy, because it appears to resolve or at least manage the problem without having to engage in all these complex political and informational and societal questions that I was alluding to. The question, however, is what does it do over the longer term? And I think, you know, we look at the attack that Hamas launched on 7th of October of last year, and in a sense, you could look upon that as the culmination of a very protracted process of having just contained, managed the problem, seeking to deter Hamas, hoping that it was going to stay under a particular threshold. So it's a very perilous game. You're sort of hoping that this relationship between the state and an insurgent group remains stable. I'm not sure that's ever the case. Politics never sleep.
There has been strategy for many years in very different theatres in Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, which was counterinsurgency, win hearts and minds, turn people over to our side. Has that gone out the window now, do you think?
Well, that is a big question. I've spent a fair few years studying it, so I'll have to try to be concise. Well, first of all, the Western experience of counterinsurgency is its own thing in many ways. And, you know, we didn't go into Iraq or Afghanistan hoping to do counterinsurgency. We went in there with this, you know, I think fairly primitive idea that if you just overthrow the government, sort of the natural impulse for democracy will just sort of, you know, explode and we'll have this, you know, regime change and wonderful stability. And obviously that didn't happen. And we've seen the same thing in Libya. You take a regime away and often you have, you know, winners and losers battling it out. And we then got stuck in these conflicts looking for an exit strategy. And the exit strategy became counterinsurgency. I think that's a fairly suboptimal starting point for this type of campaign, because they're campaigns that are usually very costly. They're campaigns that are very, you know, they require a lot of political insight, understanding of the enemy, understanding of state and society. And when you're operating abroad in a foreign country, as an occupying force, no less, those things won't come naturally. And I think, you know, in a sense, we were hoisted by the same petard in Afghanistan as we had been in Vietnam. That is to say, we didn't have a legitimate host nation partner through which to work. And so it doesn't really matter then how many forces you pour into it or how much money and resources and blood, because you're pouring into a ship that has a massive hole in its hull. The situation in Iraq is a little bit different because I think the government there had perhaps slightly stronger foundations. The problem, of course, the inescapable problem, the original sin, if you will, is that by removing Saddam Hussein and confusing, I think, his regime with the entire sort of Sunni part of the population, we had created the trappings of a very sectarian regime. So the surge, the years during Iraq when we pushed in more forces and we did local level stabilization and in concert with various Sunni tribes and other structures, I mean, I think that was quite effective. And I think, you know, you look at the casualties going down during those years. But once the U.S. forces left, you then had one Sunni power structure at the local level and a, you know, Shia-dominated power structure at the central level that were never going to get along. And I think that then put the seeds in the ground for the resurgence of ISIS and everything we saw following our exit in 2011. So it hasn't been a very happy experience. And of course, we're not really talking about counterinsurgency anymore for that reason, which, you know, in a sense makes sense. We're not going to do those things again anytime soon. But on the other hand, there are also some complications here that I think we'll see in any combat situation. You know, the idea of legitimacy, the idea of partnering with local forces, the idea of translating military gains into political realities. I mean, those things are just not going to go away. But I will add one other thing, which, of course, that really speaks to the Western experience of counterinsurgency. Outside of our radar, there are any number of conflicts where counterinsurgency is very much alive and kicking, because in a sense, it has to be, because there's insurgencies tearing these countries apart. And these insurgencies, in a sense, have some of them predate misadventures in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they still go on. And so whether we are directly involved or indirectly involved or not involved at all, this question of political violence is just still so essential. And it's not something we really can afford to ignore. If we ignore it, certainly, this is a little bit more hard-nosed, then you'll get the Wagner Group and other players in there trying to do their thing. And that's exactly what we're seeing across most of the Sahel in Africa and in other places as well.
Just a final thought. The question of political appetite in Western democracies to keep going with things. I mean, pulling out of Afghanistan led to and still leads to all kinds of suffering. Iraq has hardly been a major success for the Western powers. And yet we have got the stomach to stick by state actors. So in other words, Germany, when it was divided, the American governments had great staying power there. Korea, great staying power there as well. Is there a difference? In other words, there's a difference between the threat from Russia or North Korea and the threat from within people who are insurgents.
Yeah, that's an interesting hypothesis. I'd have to give that some more thought. I would say that one of the key differences between our occupation of Germany and Japan and even Korea was that during the Cold War, the West had perhaps a clearer idea of what it was fighting for and a clearer sense of urgency in creating a new international environment. I mean, if you think back to the Marshall Plan, for example, I mean, the level of ambition and the financing that that required to effectively, you know, make Europe safe for democracy, or at least keep the Soviet Union out, I mean, it's fairly bold. And at home, at the same time, the United States was really, in a sense, reinventing society with these vast infrastructural projects, national endowments for education, lots of information-based initiatives to try, you know, Voice of America and these sort of things. So I think, in a sense, the entire society was mobilized in support of these things because the reality of the Cold War, particularly with the advent of nuclear weapons, compelled such a response. I don't think that we're quite there today. And if we then take a similarly, you know, state-based challenge, such as the Russian invasion of Ukraine, certainly I've been very pleased to see the level of support that Ukraine has received, not least from the European Union, but of course also predominantly from the United States. But we're also witnessing a remarkable myopia, I mean, I would contend, in whether we should sustain that support. And I think, you know, you could say, I don't want to claim that, you know, the West was in any way so saintly during the Cold War. And the United States was involved in quite a lot of nasty little operations here and there. But certainly there was a sense of purpose and a sense of urgency in defending its, you know, interests, or if you want to be more charitable, its values. I'm not sure that we really communicated the same course or motivation to our electorates today. And as a result, our staying power is also reduced. I'm quite disconcerted by our inability to see why this matters and to, you know, really respond accordingly.
As David suggests, a military or insurgent threat has to be combated on many levels, politically and diplomatically, as well as by military means. Vanda Felbab-Brown pointed out in her report for Brookings that another weapon in the arsenal of democracies is that of tracing the money and therefore disrupting the supply lines of insurgent or terrorist groups. Vanda, I'd like to start by asking about the scale of the problem, where crypto comes in, and if there's really any way to stop the flow of money.
Law enforcement and, for that matter, counterterrorism officials have long dreamed about being able to defund non-state armed actors, whether they are criminal or terrorist or insurgents, right? It's always the siren song of the approach is take the money away. The reality, however, is that the world has really never succeeded in defunding any large criminal or terrorist group. One of the biggest successes was after 9/11, where for a while, US and international anti-money laundering efforts starved Al-Qaeda of money. But Al-Qaeda found ways to get around it. In practice, this is often extraordinarily challenging. So crypto today is yet another mechanism by which groups that are legal and groups that are illegal are moving money and are using for fundraising. So in the case of criminal groups, crypto is one of the ways that they try to evade the anti-money laundering systems that have been built into official banking systems. Groups like Hamas are also using crypto, including for crowdfunding for donations. Now, we really haven't been in a scenario where crypto has been the dominant source of money laundering for any of these groups. So just stick with the Hamas example. The US estimates are that Hamas makes about $1 billion a year. Crypto amounts to tens of millions, maybe 100 million of that money, where the vast majority of its income, of its funding, comes from companies, its own investment companies that it has spread around the Middle East. But right now, crypto is just a small part of that funding portfolio. And as with all technology, it's always a cat and mouse game with law enforcement. criminal groups, insurgent groups are often highly skilled and clever in adapting new technologies, whether it's drones and eventually weaponizing them, whether it's AI that we are starting to see, and certainly the possibility of AI going way beyond propaganda and recruitment for much more tactical operations by both criminal and insurgent groups.
I'm struck there by what you said about crypto being just a small part of the group's fundings, that you talked about using investment companies. Can you tell us more about that?
So, you know, to return to the example of Hamas, I mentioned that by far the most income comes from investments, legal investments they have made across the Middle East, their funding companies. In this way, Hamas follows what Iran and its Revolutionary Guards Corps pioneered and transferred toward other non-state armed actors, which is that creating significant investments in legal economies is often the surest way to generate income. Now, you know, this is ironic because we think about non-state armed actors, criminal actors, as kind of benefiting from the illegal economies, and they absolutely do, whether this is drug trafficking, including for groups like Hamas or Hezbollah or the Taliban. But by far, most money, safest money, surest money is made in the legal economy. And it is when criminal groups, insurgent groups can participate in that activity that they get not just financing, they also get a great deal of political power.
So finally, Vanda, what's to be done about all of this? To return to where we started, is it about that old phrase, follow the money?
You know, I mentioned that it's often the siren song that you will manage to bankrupt a criminal network, that you will manage to bankrupt an insurgent actor. That rarely happens. But obviously, taking some money away is useful. But very importantly, following the money gives law enforcement, gives military forces often an extremely valuable network picture. It allows them to map the wide set of actors, including external sponsors, political sponsors that are supporting the group. And it is this network picture and the ability to act in other ways to counter it through arrest, through diplomatic pressure that is perhaps as important or even more important than simply trying to reduce the financial flows. The network picture, the intelligence generated, is at least as valuable as reducing the resource base.
What's clear from these conversations is that democratic countries may need new weapons, but they also need new creative thinking. Where do our interests really lie? When are combat forces truly necessary? And when are troops in uniform merely moving targets for those who have much more staying power for a fight? During those conversations with Vanda and David, a couple of lines from the Irish poet William Butler Yeats kept coming to mind. After the Easter Rising of 1916 in Dublin, in which Irish rebels paved the way for independence, Yeats wrote that the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Perhaps when powers and superpowers with worldwide interests are involved in asymmetric warfare, they might consider the passionate intensity of those on the other side, and the lack of conviction in democracies for fighting asymmetric battles far, far away. This is Not a Drill. I'm Gavin Essler.
This is Not a Drill. It was written and presented by Gavin Essler and produced by Robin Lieber. Our music was by Paul Hartnell and art by Jim Parrott. Group editor is Andrew Harrison, executive producer Martin Boytosh, and This Is Not a Drill is a Podmasters production.